Hello, and welcome to the American Marketing Association's Marketing Power Podcast on the Future of Business is Sharing. I'm your host, Nancy Piccalo, Director of Online Content for the AMA. We're very excited to welcome our special guest, Lisa Gansky, to the program today. Lisa is the author of a new book, The Mesh, Why the Future of Business is Sharing, to be published in the fall. Since 1991, Lisa has been an entrepreneur and environmentalist focused on building companies and supporting social ventures where there is an opportunity for well-timed disruption and a resounding impact. A founder and CEO of several internet companies, including GNN, the first web portal was sold to AOL, and the largest consumer photo sharing and print service, Ophoto, which was sold to Eastman Kodak in 2001, Lisa's attention is on sustainable ventures with positive social impact. She puts a strong emphasis on clean energy, social networks, accelerating community engagement and awareness, and exploring new platforms and business models. Lisa currently serves as director and co-founder of Dos Margaritas, an environmental foundation with programs focused in Latin America. She's an advisor and investor in several social ventures, including New Resource Bank, Confio, Squiddo, Tastebook, MePlease, and Greener World Media. If you want to know what Lisa is up to, you can follow her personal tweets on Twitter at Instigating. And if you want to follow tweets on the concept of mesh, please follow Twitter at Share the Mesh. That's SHARETHEMESH. And to learn more about mesh companies and view a full directory of mesh businesses and companies, please visit the website www.meshing.it. That's MESHING.IT. Lisa, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for inviting me.
Great.
And what a mouthful that was, and I'm so impressed.
It was. You certainly have a lot of credentials behind the book, which I think has some really thoughtful insights, not only for business but for marketers in general. First, Lisa, if you could, since I know you are well-versed in the concept of mesh, can you explain to our listeners what exactly you mean when you refer to mesh?
Absolutely. I coined the term mesh really from the point of view that the mesh is based on the notion that we're moving from an economy and a lifestyle that was predominantly focused on ownership to one that's going to at least partially be oriented towards sharing. And there are some things that facilitate and underlie this pull towards sharing. One is, of course, historically, we've had a history of sharing as cultures. But there's also in business what I refer to as share platforms. So we see them a lot in cities like airports and taxis and office buildings and elevators and tunnels and hotel rooms and things like that. And so we have, these are businesses or actually ventures, investments, capital investments usually, that have been undertaken with the notion that they're going to be kind of owned and contributed to and used by many often at the same time. So we have a long history, and people like Conrad Hilton certainly have created a business out of what was a share platform. Blockbuster is another good example. Those have the opportunity to be mesh businesses, in my view, because the other thing that happens in a mesh business is it's connecting people to people and people to things. And using the data that we have from the technology that we've invested in over the last, in some cases, 50 and in some cases 10 years, depending on which flavor of technology, we have, roads and airports and the physical infrastructure. But the recent new addition have been two really important ingredients. One are social networks, and the other one is the fact that most of us are dripping with some form of communication device attached to us almost all the time, and that's our mobile phone that is at this point mostly web-enabled and has GPS. And so that's taking the friction out of finding each other and finding things. So it sets up very nicely for the sharing economy, the access economy, and the move towards what I'm calling a world in which access trumps ownership. The mesh, why I coined that term specifically, is just because as I was visualizing it, I was seeing the interconnection between us and each other and our things. And the reality is that this is the first time in the world that so many people have been connected in this way to one another. And I think that it sets up for a very different dynamic, and we can see some of that playing out right now.
Great. And as you indicated in your book, you suggest that really this is underscoring sort of a major shift in consumer behavior, again, one from ownership to sharing. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are. Is this a reflection, you think, of the recent recession we've been in, or is this really a more permanent shift? And do you think that consumers really want to share everything? And is this reflecting a broader lifestyle change for consumers?
Those are great and many questions, Nancy. Thank you. The first question is, yes, I think the recession contributed to, it set the perfect storm for the mesh in a way. It created the right environment to make the right kind of growth for the mesh. But at the same time, I don't think that it's dependent upon the recession. There are several other things that sets up for it. One is, as I mentioned, the fact that people are more connected to each other and to their things, meaning that a lot of the physical things can be mapped because they have some form of, technology in them, whether it's an RFID chip or GPS or something like that. So before, standing on the corner, like, for example, I live in the Bay Area, there's something called casual carpool. And what happens is you can go outside in certain areas, in certain neighborhoods. You can wait in a queue on the street. And if you want to go into San Francisco, a car that's coming by will stop in a particular place and pick you up so that they can go in the carpool lane and you go over the bridge free, and it's a win-win for everyone. And it's a very ad hoc and impromptu service that actually, I believe, came out of a year when there was an earthquake here and a lot of the systems were down. People kind of impromptu created that, and it stuck. That's a form of ride sharing, but it requires a lot of nuance and a lot of knowledge of the local area. I think, for example, taking ride share as an example, with mobile phones and the web and GPS, it's really incredibly easy to imagine, especially in a high-density location, standing out and just being able to see, cars go by as you're standing on a corner heading over the bridge in this case, easy for them to take you, but no way for you to coordinate with them. And so the technology has enabled us to take the friction and take the inconvenience out of sharing in ways that we didn't have before. But there's also, I think, a number of other things that contribute to it, including the younger generation. For example, with cars and driving, there's a lot of studies that have been done. For the last 30 years, something that I didn't know until doing this book, or I could have looked at my nephews and nieces, I suppose, but the younger generation, who are sort of 25 to, let's say 15, their orientation towards driving, it's not a rite of passage that in the moment that, the atomic clock hits their 16th or 17th birthday, they need to go get their driver's license. Mm-hmm. And so that shift, in fact, is very much delayed. Their orientation is much more towards things like car sharing and bike sharing and mass transit. And the reason often is because it doesn't have the status associated with it of autonomy and other goodies that was the case when I was a kid. So I think what we're seeing is some real fundamental social changes. Of course, climate change is playing a role as well. And I think the technology has just enabled a different kind of reality that we're embracing. What was you had another question in there, though.
I think what we were talking about is this a permanent shift? I mean, do we really think that?
Oh, I think it's a permanent as permanence can be. I think that we're at the beginning of something new. And I think when we look at Facebook and Twitter, and when we look at things like Foursquare and Gowalla and Groupon, mm-hmm. we're seeing the very beginning of a phenomenon as marketers, as business people, and as citizens that is going to shape probably the next couple of decades in terms of how we interact with products and brands and each other.
you know, certainly this concept, you know, has a lot of value for consumers in particular and businesses, but, you know, certainly it alters the traditional role of a marketer, and which is essentially has been to convince consumers to buy lots more of new products and services. So I'm wondering, as this new business model takes hold, given all those factors that you just discussed, how do you believe this will change the marketing task?
I think that it's a terrific question, and I've obviously, given that I have marketing DNA, have thought a lot about it. You know, I would say a couple of ways. One is that there's already been a shift taking place that we can see when we look at, you know, a number of companies. I mean, BP is the first one that comes to mind because they've had the most conspicuous issue as a disconnect between the positioning of the Beyond Petroleum brand and the action in the public world. I think that the idea that we as marketers can sit in a room and massage the brand and massage the offers into something that we want and then push it out and have people swallow it in the form that we want them to take it in is just not the case. And there's a number of stories in the book that I won't illuminate here, but essentially, it's become that friends and social network have much more influence over people's buying habits and who they trust and what they do with their money than what the company says about itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that fundamental shift is coincident with the mesh, but it's not, the mesh is a bigger thing than that, but I think that reality of having, pull marketing or peer-to-peer marketing be so influential in reality. And, in fact, in some cases, you know, our ability as marketers is really to be on top of, like a control tower, be on top of what people are saying in these various, social networks and communities.
Mm-hmm.
So services like Get Satisfaction is one that I'm aware of here in the States. Is a peer-to-peer kind of customer service platform that allows people, marketers and other people in the organization to really listen more kind of directly and palpably to how the community is being, responding to something. But I think essentially we have tools now that we didn't have. We have a reality that we didn't have before, but we also have tools now that we didn't have before. And embracing those tools and understanding that the shift is, you know, people have the perceptions they have. We really have to understand the perceptions, hear them, and be responsive to them with a fresh and authentic and quick voice, as opposed to, you know, stay in our conference rooms and mm-hmm. and push out the message we wish that they would accept.
Yeah, those are really great insights, I think, especially given what's already been going on in the social media sphere. As you indicated in your book, there are a number of companies that this really isn't new to them yet. You know, they've already been doing it well. Zipcar, Groupon are two sort of examples. I'm wondering, are there any products or service categories that this concept doesn't apply to? And are there any product categories that you think consumers don't want to share?
I would say probably no to the first question and probably yes to the second, at least for now. every company can shift their business strategy to have a more mesh strategy. A mesh strategy is one that, if we take Zipcar as an example, or Netflix, which is another really good mesh company that most of us are familiar with, it's essentially taking something that we used to own, cars or DVDs, and saying, hey, you can share this. And so, you know, I think when I get a DVD from Netflix and open up my mail, the first thought I have is not, wow, I wonder who had this before me. It doesn't even occur to me. The fact that it's a shared product is kind of so much of a feature that I don't even think about it kind of invading me in any other way. I think cars are right on the cusp for some generations and have crossed over already to be very much like DVDs for other generations, where it's simply a tool and a utility and not something that's part of their personal identity. And so in those examples, the mesh companies are ones that are taking a product that we would have historically bought once, and they're creating many iterative interactions and transactions and touch points where they can have a relationship with that customer, their family, and their friends. And as a result of all those interactions, there's an enormous amount of data, and that data that gets generated from the interactions with the customer, the interactions from the car manufacturers or the various studios, give in the case of Zipcar or Netflix, an enormous ability to microcast, to plan, to make really compelling and irresistible offers to customers. Excuse me. Furthermore, the partnerships that come from those or are possible help with the extending peripheral vision where the data might end. You can create partnerships that would extend to other demographics or to other areas of the particular demographic that you're interested in, their lifestyle. So mm-hmm. once they, you know, drop off the car, what you think they might want to do next. And I think that the mesh businesses that we've seen so far in those two cases have done an extraordinary job of partnerships and gleaning data to make timely offers and leverage social networks. The second question you asked, did you want to say something?
No, go ahead.
The second question you asked, I think, was...
do we think that this, are there any, you know, sort of categories that this does not work for consumers?
I think the hardest category is something like consumer electronics, where we've created disposable products historically, and those products have been, you know, sold and then basically on a fairly regular basis tossed. I guess that would also apply to, you know, other things like fashion, and mm-hmm. where there's kind of a seasonal, you know, you kind of expect that you're going to go through clothes and then kind of toss them. I think that's been the mentality of a lot of people that I've spoken to. What we're seeing is more of a an interest in, if you're finished with something, then you kind of find another home for it, whether that's, you know, donating, recycling, or something like that. In the case of the electronics, and if I'm a retailer, certainly my job has historically been to sell product over and over. But we're seeing, like with Best Buy, for example, in the U.S., the Geek Squad has given them mm-hmm. a huge leg up in this way because it's a service and they connect to customers and it allows them to see what's going on in the home and office and to see trends and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. What I imagine is that retailers are going to start to be the center of gravity for the reclamation of goods when they're at the end of the life or at the end of the useful life for families. And they're going to be sort of right at the vortex for handing off to their ecosystem for recycling, and they're going to squeeze what we used to call waste much harder, and what they're going to find is that there's a lot more value in what we have been calling waste. So their business models will shift, but I believe everybody can adapt. They just need to begin to test, to play with ways that they can interact with consumers and engage people in the mesh.
You know, in your book, I thought you made a couple of really interesting predictions, one of which was building on what you were just talking about, that said that you predict that in less than 2 years there will be thousands of these sharing businesses that will form a global network that you're calling Grupo Mesh, which will make it easier for companies to start doing some of these things, sharing data, tools, teams, best practices. So if that is indeed the case, what should a business and marketers do to prepare for this change, and how will they then compete with other mesh companies?
I'm a big fan of trying things. You know, friends of mine with a firm called Trend Watching in the UK refer to it as trivertising, which I've picked up. I refer to it in some cases as friendvertising, and my old thing was, which I still adhere to, is define, refine, and scale. That the fabulous thing with the web and a lot of these services that we mentioned earlier, you know, Groupon and Foursquare and such, allow us to really microcast offers or run serial offers, excuse me, and get a lot of run serial or parallel offers and get a lot of immediate feedback, allowing us to adjust pricing or to try different partnerships. Well, what if we partnered with this brand or this kind of product? Would that, you know, give us more credibility? Would it make us kind of more hip? Would it make us, you know, does it make the offer more compelling in a variety of ways? And so our ability as marketers to try a lot of things, learn from those trials before your competitors is really what the game is all about. It's make mistakes early, you know, make cheap mistakes early is what I sort of have attempted to do myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great point. I think the last question I just want to ask, in order to really have businesses make this jump or this shift, it certainly will need to make sense from a bottom line perspective, and certainly marketers are well aware of that. So in your opinion, does this trend to sharing equate to or even exceed sales and growth numbers for business today that will depend on consumers, you know, no longer needing to own it but rather share it?
Well, I mean, the best example I have in this morning is Netflix. You know, if we look at Blockbuster versus Netflix, Blockbuster was an enormous success. It was, you know, it took over many of its competitors and had a very substantial market cap, not less than a couple of years ago. Netflix has come on strong for a whole host of reasons, but fundamentally what's at the core of their strategy is they're doing classic mesh maneuvers, and that's benefited them greatly to the point where, you know, I think this morning their stock was at $150, and Apple and Amazon seem to be midget mud wrestling over who thinks they're going to buy them. So...
Yeah, that's great. You know, these have really been great insights today, and certainly I think give marketers a lot to think about as they're looking at how companies will be providing products and services in the near term. So thank you. We've been talking to Lisa Gansky today, and thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to this edition of our AMA podcast series. I hope it's been a good learning and listening experience for you. Look for information on other upcoming podcasts by visiting marketingpower.com/podcasts. Make sure you sign up for our feed on Marketing Power so you're aware of all of our podcast series. And for information about Lisa's book, The Mesh, The Future of Business is Sharing, and how to reserve and purchase a copy, please visit our online AMA bookstore. Until next time, I've been your host, Nancy Pacala. Thank you for joining us.